From Michigan Radio, this is Stateside. I'm Cynthia Canty. Today, how are women doing in Michigan? One researcher says not so well.
When you really look at the numbers, it just hurts a little bit.
A U of M law grad hopes to sell low-cost bail insurance in Michigan.
There are 500,000 people in this country sitting each day in jail simply because they can't make bail.
Scientists dig at the bottom of the Great Lakes seeking a cancer cure in fungi.
We were shocked that the Great Lakes, despite being one of these largest freshwater bodies in the world, they just didn't have any record of an entire kingdom of life, the kingdom of fungi.
And John U. Bacon on the Lions' new head coach.
Hard times are these, my friend Cindy, when probably the best hope you have for the next season in Detroit, amongst the four major sports, are the Lions.
Those stories and more today on Stateside. Hello and welcome to Stateside. I'm Cynthia Canty. Michigan's no-fault insurance law is seen as the gold standard in this country in terms of medical care for drivers badly hurt in a car accident. Michigan also has the highest insurance cost in the nation, although various fixes have been floated through the years for our high auto insurance costs. Nothing gets traction in the state legislature. Well, now comes a new idea for some GOP lawmakers. Just get rid of no-fault. Chad Livengood of Crane's Detroit Business is with us now via Skype. So our no-fault system means injured drivers get their medical bills paid no matter who causes the accident. So who's proposing we get rid of that and why?
Well, these are mostly border county legislators who live along the borders of Ohio, Indiana, and Wisconsin, where they are in tort states. States have litigation-based systems where drivers have to go to court to sue the at-fault driver who caused their accident, caused damage to their vehicles, and caused damage to their bodies. And that's a different, totally different system than what Michigan lives in, this no-fault system, where regardless of who was at fault, the bills get paid. And because of that, you have this higher amount of liability that we pay for. We pay for a minimum of $550,000 liability. Then we have a system that where if you're catastrophically injured, we pay for those injuries. But in other states, they don't have that kind of backstop. You simply buy a certain amount of policy. There's usually minimum standards, and this proposal would be a $20,000 minimum. So if in Ohio, you could be driving with the $20,000 minimum, and you could be hit by a driver with a $1 million minimum, and you get coverage of your costs, if you win in court, of course, up to $1 million. Whereas if that other driver hit you, you would get $20,000. And that's how a tort system works, and that's what's now being sort of proposed as an alternative to no fault, given all the years of inaction on this issue.
So these lawmakers who are kind of along the border are able to see firsthand, for example, how much lower rates must be in those states with the tort system.
Yeah, Representative Jason Shepard from Temperance, he lives a mile from the border himself and hasn't actually had his own experience getting in a car accident in Ohio. And so he's been through the tort litigation system down there. And so he's one of the proponents of this, but he also hears it from neighbors, basically, who say, well, look, if I could just pick up and move across the border, I'd pay half for auto insurance. And this problem in Sturgis and Coldwater and Escanaba, all along these areas where there are populated areas, people can move with their feet on this issue and other issues, too. This is one area where people feel like we are at a competitive disadvantage because of our high auto insurance costs.
In your story for Crane's Detroit Business, you talk about what happened when Colorado switched from no fault to a tort system in 2002. Tell us about that.
Well, they saw a shift in who pays, basically. It went from a system where the private auto insurance, the no-fault coverage, was paying most of the bills to more than a quarter of the bill being paid by the government, by Medicaid. And then you have this problem when you take away this unlimited benefit or a medical benefit, you also just get people who can't pay. They turn into charity case coverage and their bills simply go unpaid, and that creates a financial problem and burden for hospitals. We passed the Affordable Care Act in this country and got the Medicaid expansion in Michigan to try to cut down on the amount of charity care and uncompensated care. That has proven out. In this case, if you take away this medical benefit, you're either going to fall back on Medicaid or people who don't have insurance, who are, there are still people out there, going without insurance, especially with the individual mandate going away, essentially, you have problems where people will just not be able to pay for those injuries or those medical bills from hospitals.
When Michigan's no-fault law came in, hard to believe, 45 years old, this law, it was supposed to get rid of lawsuits. Has that happened?
Initially, it did, but over time, through a series of different types of court cases and rulings that have kind of ate away at this law, we have seen a rise of a different type of litigation that was not envisioned by the drafters of this law, that essentially people are going and hiring personal injury attorneys to fight for their benefits, to get maximum amount of benefits, both for their medical claims, for their long-term care, and also for lost wages. And then these attorneys who kind of crafted a business out of this, they basically go and fight for you. You see these billboards up and down the highway, and you see them advertised on the back of buses and on television. They go out and take insurance companies to court to try to get maximum amount of benefits under what is known as first-party lawsuit, and then they take a third of whatever they can collect.
So kind of the initial idea behind that, as you say, has been eroded.
Yeah, it's cut into this law, and because of a series of different complicated court cases, it's opened up an area where now one in three civil litigation cases in Michigan courts is auto insurance related, either in this first party cases or the third party pain and suffering lawsuits where you sue someone who is the at-fault driver who caused you a great change in your life. If, God forbid, they put you in a wheelchair, you can sue that person, that driver, for non-economic damages. That's different than these other types of lawsuits where people are just simply suing to get as maximum benefit out of the insurance company.
So here we have this group of Republican lawmakers kind of floating this plan. Let's abolish the no-fault law. How much chance do they give this of passing?
Well, Representative Aaron Miller from Sturgis is one of the sponsors. He was pretty frank that he thinks it has a snowball's chance in hell of actually passing. That's partly because this is such a divided issue, and because this would be even more drastic of a change than has been proposed just simply reforming no-fault, which is a proposal that died in the House back in November. What looks more likely here is that this is going to head towards the lame duck session in December, when we're going to have half the legislature changing over and a governor leaving office. And it will be a three-week opportunity to try to make a reform, because if you don't do it now, it'll take a couple years to re-educate a whole new class of legislators on this issue, which is immensely complicated.
And a lot of the folks that would pass that won't be around to feel the repercussions.
That's right. That's the way term limits works.
Chad Livengood, Crane's Detroit Business, as always. Thank you so much, Chad.
Thanks for having me.
And now time for our weekly check-in with Michigan Radio sports commentator John U. Bacon. And we have got to start out with that absolute roller coaster ride the Wings put themselves and their fans through over the weekend. Friday night against the Islanders, Sunday against Washington. You blow a 3-goal lead, you fight back to tie the game. Friday night, they lost in overtime. Sunday, an overtime win courtesy of Thomas Tatar and Dylan Larkin. That was a happy ending. But John, counter that with that stunning Friday night collapse. 4 goals against the Wings while Tyler Bertuzzi set out a 5-minute major penalty?
To back this one up, folks, this is a little hockey nightmare for you. They're ahead 5-2 with about, 4.5 minutes left?
Yeah.
Now, Bertuzzi takes a 5-minute major, which, by the way, is almost always a colossally stupid penalty, and his was no exception. So right there, you're being dumb, undisciplined, selfish. I say these things as a former high school hockey coach. If one of my players had done that, he would rather be in the penalty box and be on the bench next to me. Or his teammates, for that matter, because they would have something to say about it also.
Sure.
This is colossally stupid.
4 goals in that time.
And then a 5-minute major, unlike other penalties, A, it's 5 minutes versus 2 minutes.
Yeah.
Second thing, more importantly, almost more importantly, is after you score on a normal penalty, the guy gets out of the penalty box. And a 5-minute major, you stay in the entire 5 minutes, no matter how many they score. And the answer is they scored four. In 4.5 minutes, so you end up losing. The whole thing's a mess.
And then they equalize and then lose in overtime.
Exactly.
Jeez. The inconsistency.
Equalize. Soccer fan right
there.
There
you go.
By the
That's
way.
True. Is this coaching? Is it talent? Is it experience?
Yes.
All the above. Okay.
And here's what we can't tell, in fairness to Jeff Blashill, the coach, who I've been writing a bit here and there, is that we don't have a control group. We don't know how much is roster, how much is him, how much is experience, et cetera, because he's not coached anywhere else in the NHL before. So we really can't compare this team to his other teams. I can tell you that it is February, and my team in February would not take a five-minute major, and they wouldn't let four goals score. So this is truly fundamental hockey, which would have me around the bend with 16-year-old kids who knew better than this.
Let alone highly paid NHL
players. They're not millionaires, not one of them. So this is not good.
Speaking of hockey, we should keep our eye on the U.S. Olympic team.
We should, because it's the first time since 1994 that non-NHL players are playing in the Olympics, including Michigan's own Andrew Ebbett, playing for the Canadian team, former NHLer, and Chad Kaloric, former star at the University of Michigan. So those guys, he's playing for the U.S. team. So that'll be fun.
Chris Chelios coaching.
And Chris Chelios coaching.
Coach.
Yes, exactly. Look, quick point here is the hockey is the world's greatest sport, says me, utterly biased, and the dumbest league, the NHL, who is not sending their best players to a world showcase to drum up interest in your league and your players. The NBA never misses for a reason, and the NHL, here they are.
Let's go over the Lions now that Matt Patricia has cut his hair, trimmed his beard, put his suit on, and he's the new head coach, and Bob Quinn got a two-year contract extension. Do you feel like the Lions now have, I'm going to use air quotes here, something with these two joining forces that they haven't had till now?
Nothing better for radio than air quotes.
That's right, as I do them with my hands.
Or puppet tricks.
What do you think?
What do I think? The downside I'll give you first, and that is that Bill Belichick, the best coach in the NFL, clearly, with the New England Patriots, his coaching tree has not done that well, actually. His former proteges out in the league. However, I don't care. Bob Quinn, former New England Patriot executive, is now GM at the Lions. And, of course, Matt Patricia, defensive coordinator, who did only so okay in the Super Bowl. I don't care. You've got two professionals who are from a first-class program. They know what they're doing. They've got a track record. This is the best chance the Lions have had in my lifetime to field a consistent winner. And hard times are these, my friend Cindy, when probably the best hope you have for the next season in Detroit, amongst the four major sports, are the Lions. I can't recall that either.
Speaking of the four major sports, we haven't had a chance to get your thoughts on the news that the Tigers made that change to the home uniforms for the first time in 50 years, and now the old English D on the cap and the home jersey will be identical. How come all the breathless headlines?
Because we care deeply about these silly things like that old English D on that white jersey. I recall one magazine called years ago, the best uniforms in baseball are not the Yankees, but the Tigers' home uniform. They are the tuxedos of baseball. You don't mess with those. And the reason they are messing with them is the most cynical reason possible. And that is because they know the team is going to stink this year. So how do you drum up some merchandise sales? You change the logo on the jersey, making all of us buy this quote-unquote new jersey. So look, when you take over the Tigers, there are certain things you don't do, and messing with the D is five of them. Don't do it, and they did it.
Michigan Radio Sports commentator John Eubacon. Thanks, John.
Thank you.
And we'll be back after a short break. You're listening to Stateside. I'm Cynthia Canty. You're listening to Stateside. I'm Cynthia Canty.
This is the future.
You built a time machine out of a DeLorean?
It's alive!
It's the sound of science!
Could a fungus from the bottom of the Great Lakes hold a cure for cancer? We're nowhere near the final answer, but a team of scientists believes there's promise in newly discovered Great Lakes fungi. One of the researchers is with us now. Robert Chiovich once lived in West Michigan. He went to grad school at Michigan State. These days, he is a natural products professor at the University of Oklahoma. It is a pleasure to welcome you to Stateside.
Well, hi. Thank you. This is fun.
Well, now tell me first about this field of natural products, because I'm going to admit I don't know that I've ever encountered someone who's a professor of natural products.
Well, natural products are these amazing molecules that are made by all sorts of things from nature, bacteria, plants, marine organisms, all sorts of different sources. These molecules have an immense impact on human life as we know it. Roughly half or more of the drugs that are currently approved by the FDA have their origins in nature, and they have tremendous impact, especially if we zero in on fungi, just considering probably the most important molecule ever discovered from fungus, penicillin. That molecule has changed the course of history, and we owe a lot to it as a society. So yeah, natural products are amazing.
So you have taken up the torch that is passed on from Fleming when he discovered what penicillin would do.
Absolutely, and you could trace that back even further to the use of crude drugs from plants and other organisms going way, way back. So yes, natural products has a history going back, before history was even written down.
So what was the project that led you and your fellow researchers to start thinking, you know what, we want to start digging at the bottom of the Great Lakes?
As a drug discovery group, we are always looking for new organisms, and new organisms oftentimes translate into new molecules, new natural products that they make. And so looking for these novel sources led us to an exploration of the Great Lakes. And I'll say that my upbringing in Western Michigan has, I guess, planted that seed that's always been in my head about wanting to go there. And this just all came together as a wonderful opportunity. We were launching a project to look for leads that would have potential applications toward pediatric cancers and underserved population of patients there just aren't adequate drugs for. And so in looking for what kind of fungi would we be sourcing for this, it seemed like an amazing opportunity to come back to the Great Lakes, because we were shocked that the Great Lakes, despite being one of these largest freshwater bodies in the world, they just didn't have any record of an entire kingdom of life, the kingdom of fungi, being recorded from them. So we dug in and came up with lots and lots and lots of new organisms, new records for the Great Lakes, as well as many new species coming from the bottom of Lake Michigan, Superior, and even Huron to some extent.
So an extra bonus, as well as this search for something to tackle pediatric cancer, all these digs you did really contributed to knowledge of what's living at the bottom of the Great Lakes.
Yes, it had a dual purpose in the end.
So you basically start scooping up stuff from the bottom of the lake. Tell us what the process was and what you did with the goop you collected.
Sure. So the process and project was highly collaborative. The person involved in collecting these samples is Dr. Mark Luttington. Turns out that as an undergraduate at Grand Valley State, Dr. Luttington was one of my professors, and he also planted the seeds of doing research in the Great Lakes way back when with me. And I had contacted him with the idea of exploring the Great Lakes. He had access through the Annis Water Research Institute to be able to sample all over the lakes. So he would collect the samples from these various positions. They would then get split and shipped both to my lab, where we do fungal culturing, as well as mycologist's lab, our collaborator Andrew Miller. He works at University of Illinois, and he is an expert in fungi. So he would culture fungi using certain conditions. We would culture fungi here using other conditions. And then we would combine that collection. We'd grow them, prepare extracts, and test them with our cancer collaborator, Dr. Susan Mooberry. She's been a longtime friend and partner working on cancer drug discovery. Phenomenal pharmacologist. She would test and then tell us which samples had the highest probability of being extra good for exploring. And then we would grow them up in large scale and then work on identifying the compounds responsible being made by that fungus for killing a specific pediatric cancer cell line.
Am I correct that the fungi you found were particularly happy to grow on Cheerios?
Oh, yes, you are correct. That is something we came up with several years ago. Anytime you're trying to do drug discovery, especially the way that we approach it, we try to look through as many strains as possible, do things in larger numbers as possible, and it can get costly. And we are federally funded for our research, and we are always looking for ways to save money and help the taxpayers receive even bigger bang for the buck in the research that we do. And for a variety of scientific reasons as well, we were exploring all sorts of different food sources and ultimately came upon Cheerios as this amazing food source for fungi. Basically, every fungus that we culture grows on them. They make tons of natural products. You can get a hold of them in bulk at excellent prices, so it's a wonderful fungus food.
That's fascinating. I will remember that when we're pouring that bowl of Cheerios tomorrow morning at breakfast. So you weren't looking for, like, the kind of compound that would kill off a lot of cells. You wanted it to be selective.
Absolutely. That is the key thing. Every cancer patient can tell you stories about the chemo that they receive and all the side effects. Basically, side effects, you're seeing the ugly head of these other targets that these drugs are hitting and poisoning the cancer, but it's also poisoning the body to some extent. And so the more selective, the more tuned you can have that molecule to hitting just the cancer and not all these other off targets, the better off the cancer patient will be. And if you can imagine an adult and the suffering they go through chemo treatment, just imagine what it's like for a child. So zeroing down, trying to find those molecules that have really great selectivity for their particular cancer is going to do wonders for them as a patient population. I just can't imagine having a child, being a parent of four children. If one of my children had to go through that, I mean, that would be absolutely horrific. And moreover, even if they do manage to survive their cancer, and I'm referring to pediatric cancer patients, if they manage to survive that round of chemotherapy and they go into remission, oftentimes these kids are looking at, in their late 20s and 30s, at secondary cancers caused by the original chemotherapy they received. So you want to find something that is as tuned to and selective for their cancers as possible.
So what did you find? What was the most promising fungus you found, and what type of cancer do you feel that it might hold hope for?
Well, one of the cancers in the panel that we screen for is Ewing sarcoma. So it's a solid tumor that affects primarily bone in children, oftentimes in their teens, sometimes 20s is when you see it. There aren't a huge number of cases, roughly a couple thousand per year that are diagnosed, but there's nothing out there specifically to treat it. About half the kids who get these cancers respond to them. That is, they go into remission. The other half, unfortunately, succumb to their disease at a very young age. The unfortunate thing, however, about these survivors is that, as I just pointed out, the drugs that they receive are quite toxic, so they inevitability end up getting a secondary cancer and dying later in life as a result of that original tumor that they got.
So you found one that seemed to be pretty specific for this.
That is correct. And that, I would say, is really one of the remarkable highlights of the project at this point. This molecule that we've been so fortunate to find comes from a fungus. It is shows incredible selectivity for the Ewing sarcoma. We are working right now with Susan's group as well as some of her additional collaborators in the field of pediatric cancer. We've got quite a team who's working on this molecule right now, trying to figure out how it works, what its promise is in terms of actual application, looking at a huge range of tests, both in pharmacology and toxicology right now. I'd say this is one of the molecules that, after being in the field of natural products, in an independent position at Oklahoma since 2005, this is one of the few molecules that really gets me hyped up. This is very exciting.
So it's something to keep our eye on. Certainly there is a long way to go before you could point to something that would be given to a patient.
Absolutely, and I'm glad you pointed that out. It's unfortunate. You know, we all get excited about our research, and we want to share it with people and get other people excited about it. The reality of drug discovery is that the discoveries of today, you're typically talking 10, 15, 20 years until it ends up in a human. And you know, there's a lot of steps to go through, but it's meant for people's safety. And it's hard to be patient when people are dying and there's nothing that you can do. But that patience is what makes, I think, the U.S. medical system so strong, is that we have a lot of protection for patients.
Professor Robert Cievich, who is a natural products professor at the University of Oklahoma. Some fascinating research, and when we think of Great Lakes fungi, realizing that perhaps there is a life-saving something in that fungi. Thank you so much for sharing your work with us.
Well, thank you very much.
You're listening to Stateside. I'm Cynthia Canty. As part of the University of Michigan's bicentennial celebration, the U of M Library brought StoryCorps to campus last fall to capture the personal stories of the people who make up the university's rich history. One of those conversations featured U of M librarian Karen Downing. She sat down with her father, Harold Johnson, and they talked about what it was like to make history as the first Black dean at the University of Michigan.
In 1981, you became the first Black dean at the university. I was an undergraduate at the U of M then, and I remember being so proud of you and a bit aghast that you were the first. Talk about what it was like being the first Black dean.
Well, it was difficult. Not so much being dean, but I think being perhaps the most prominent Black on campus, or at least Black with the most visibility on campus. Because what happened was that students and faculty who had problems of any kind would come to me with their problems. Sometimes I could refer them to someone else. Other times I tried to help them personally. But it sort of doubled the workload. I had to run the school and also sort of take care of many members of the Black community on campus, both faculty and students. So it was kind of onerous, and there also were people who certainly resented the fact that I was Black and dean, including some members of my faculty, and they tried to make life difficult for me. But I think all in all, it went reasonably well, and I think fairly proud of my accomplishments as dean. We became the number one school. That was my goal when I took the job. I said I was going to make it the number one school of social work in the country, and I think it took me about 3 years to get there. And the school has maintained that ranking, I think, every year since. That was about 1984, except for 1 year when the George Warren Brown School of Social Work at Washington University in St. Louis was ranked number one. So I think it was a successful appointment.
When you look back on your career, do you have any thoughts about things that you would do differently or things that you are most proud of?
Well, I think I would have liked to have become president of the University of Michigan. And maybe I should have. In 1978, I was recommended to become provost. The regents, in their wisdom, decided not to approve the recommendation made by Harold Shapiro, who was president at the time. Their rationale was there were two names given to them, and they said the other person wasn't qualified. So, in fact, they were only given one name, and they said they wanted two names. So they asked the search committee to go back and come up with some more names. The search committee declined and said, we did our job, we gave you two qualified people, and that's it. We're not going to do it again. So I was not approved. If I had have become provost at that time, I was certainly in line to become president of the university. And you know, that was kind of a bitter experience, and as far as I'm concerned, it was the refusal was based strictly on race and nothing more.
This is during the time that one of the regents was openly speaking in racist ways.
Yep, there was one particular regent who I will not name, but was very anti-minority, anti-gay, anti-Jewish, anti-everything,
yeah.
You know. But that left a bad taste, you know, in my mouth for a long time. Then, of course, they turned around and appointed me dean. Would I have done things differently? I don't think so. If I had to do it again, I might have pushed on some things a little harder than I did, although I'd pushed to the point of, you know, being excluded from certain kinds of activities and gatherings and so on and so forth. I was always kind of an outlier, you know. But in terms of, you know, the administration of the school or the time I served as counsel to the president or secretary of the university, I think I did about as good a job as could be done.
That was Harold R. Johnson talking with his daughter, Karen Downing, about making history as the first Black dean at the University of Michigan. These interviews were recorded by StoryCorps, www.storycorps.org. For more from the series, visit arts.umich.edu/StoryCorps. Coming up on The Next Idea, a U of M law grad hoping to sell low-cost bail insurance in Michigan.
There are 500,000 people in this country sitting each day in jail simply because they can't make bail.
Stay with us. You're listening to Stateside from Michigan Radio. You're listening to Stateside. I'm Cynthia Canty.
Experimentation.
Vision.
The next idea.
People mean very different things whenever they talk about innovation.
If you're arrested and you're charged with a crime, you'll likely be asked to post bail. We hear that term. Bail is, of course, the money a defendant hands over to the court in order to be released from custody until trial. So if you don't have a huge bank account, where are you supposed to find, let's say, $50,000? Traditionally, people go to a bail bondsman. Today's guest on The Next Idea has a different concept in mind. Judd Grutman got his law degree from the University of Michigan, and among various projects, he is working on developing a company called Vonzella, which would be a change to the current bail system. He's with us now. Judd, welcome to The Next Idea.
Thanks so much for having me.
So many of our listeners might not understand just how the bail bond system works. Can you briefly explain it to us?
Sure, yeah. It's a good question because it's something that happens to people every day across the country, and a lot of us don't know much about it. But so assume you get arrested and the state decides to move forward with a case against you. You go before a judge, and a judge decides whether to release you or not. And more often than not, the conditions of that release are financial ones, and this is usually what we consider to be bail, and that's a amount of money you have to pay to be released while you wait trial, and you generally get it back if you attend all your hearings.
What do you think this system does, or what does it mean to people accused of a crime?
Well, right now it's functioning in a way that it's really jeopardizing people's presumption of innocence, because the two options people have really aren't options for them. The first is to pay themselves. And like you were saying, you know, where do you get that money? And it's really difficult. And most people don't have that. The average American only has about $400 in savings. And so when you have bail figures that are really high, you know, it's just not an option.
Because the other option is you stay in jail, right?
Right. Well, or the second other option is that you can go see a bondsman. And the bondsmen, though, aren't necessarily an option for you either. And we know that because there are 500,000 people in this country sitting each day in jail simply because they can't make bail. So those would be customers for bondsmen, but they aren't being serviced.
What does the bondsman do? We hear that term, bail bondsman. So what does it mean if I'm accused and I don't have $50,000 and I reach out to a bail bondsman? What happens?
Well, so bail bondsmen are a lot of help to people sometimes. They basically step in your shoes and go before a court and promise that their client, you, will show up in court. And what they do is they take a percentage, usually 10%, of whatever the bail amount that's set by the court. And so they enable people to make bail because they don't have to bring up the whole amount of money.
So what's this alternative that you're working on, Judd? What would bail insurance be?
Yeah, we're basically treating being arrested like a fire or theft or a car accident. And what that means is that if you get arrested, we'd help you make bail. And so for a low monthly premium, again, we would help people out when they get arrested.
How'd you get this idea?
Well, I sat in a lot of courts across the country, and most of my time actually was in the 36th District Court in Detroit. And I just watched a lot of arraignments happen. And I, you know, you don't need an economics degree or any advanced degree really to see that it's obvious that the bail amounts that are being set are just not attainable for people. And so what's happening is like you were saying, a lot of people just get stuck in jail. And that has really negative consequences for them and their families and just about everyone else. A lot of people say that you're 3 times more likely to be convicted if you're awaiting trial behind bars. And those that are stuck behind bars generally receive 3 more years in time to serve. And so that's just devastating for people.
So how do you feel that Vonzella, this idea of bail insurance, would be an improvement over the current system?
Well, it really would empower people to know that they can make bail. And that's a big deal because what's happening now is bail is being used as a major point of leverage to get plea deals out of people. So if people knew that they could pay bail in a very vulnerable period of time in their lives, it would make a big difference because I think you'd see a lot of people not taking a plea for something they didn't do necessarily.
So who do you see as a potential buyer of this, of bail insurance? I know you're still setting the company up. So who would want this, do you think?
Well, this is something that you could get for a loved one, not just yourself. So, you know, when you sit in a court, you see that there's a lot of mothers and aunts and grandmothers coming to arraignments and helping out their children and loved ones. So we definitely see this as something that can be bought both by people who have direct experience with the correctional system themselves and people who know of others. So we see this as just a way to really protect people's economic security, because when people are faced with bail, it really puts that in jeopardy.
Now, where are you right now in the process of making Vonzella a reality?
Well, we're ready to launch a product, but it's pretty difficult to do so because of the regulations associated with insurance. And this happens in all states, but Michigan is particularly difficult because of the financial barriers of entry to selling and advertising insurance. And so we've been struggling to get a product off the ground. I am a lawyer, and so I'm trying to, you know, follow the rules, but it's difficult to innovate and to bring something new to the market without really bringing something to the table that's not possible for a single person and for a new company. And so we're working on ways to bring pilots to cities so that we can test the model and prove to insurance carriers that we're worth partnering with.
So that's kind of the big hurdle for coming into Michigan is the insurance industry.
Absolutely, yeah. I mean, there's generally sort of no room for waivers to get licenses to sell insurance. And so because of that, it's really limiting the market to traditional companies that already have significant assets.
Did I hear that this idea kind of occurred to you from reading about something called burial insurance that used to be popular in the African American community?
Yeah, that's actually really interesting. So over the progression of this company, an advisor from Penn Law School started working with me, and he was actually a tough sell at first in trying to get him to be an advisor for the company. But by the end of the call, he said, you know, you really need to read this book. And it was about how Prudential really had its roots in what they called burial insurance, which was a product that people who couldn't afford traditional life insurance products and also couldn't afford to bury their loved ones when it came to that unfortunate time, they sold this insurance product that enabled people to cover that life expense. And so when he and I finished our initial conversation, he was sort of leaving me with the feeling that, like, this was a modern-day industrial insurance or a modern-day burial insurance. And actually, since he and I have talked about that, there are other companies in foreign countries who are now selling burial insurance. So it is something that seems to be recurring, and I think it's because we are seeing a lot of economic inequality that's really affecting people and causing certain life events to be significant sort of disasters for people.
And speaking of the economic gap, what are you thinking in terms of what a monthly premium might be? Would this be affordable for lower income people?
Absolutely. I mean, that's who we have in mind. And after spending some time in Detroit, like I was saying, we really think we can get this to be at a low cost. I mean, that's competitive even with, you know, like a cell phone insurance product. We haven't set a price yet, but we think we can get it as low as about $10 a month.
Any sense of how long it'll be before this might be available in Michigan?
You know, I don't know. I'm trying to work now with a nonprofit organization to get a pilot going, and we're ready to do it. We just need to get approval from the state. So that's what we're working on.
Judd Grutman is the founder of Vonzella, basically giving people a chance to buy bail insurance. We want to thank you so much for being a part of the Next Idea, Judd.
Thank you.
Support for the Next Idea on Stateside comes from Michigan Economic Development Corporation, committed to marketing Michigan to drive job growth and investment in our communities. MichiganBusiness.org.
A skillful mining of data can give you a pretty good snapshot of just how groups of people are faring, for better or for worse. Sarah Zerpicki wanted to learn just how Michigan women are faring in education, health, and the economy. She presented her findings in some blog posts for Michigan Future, the nonprofit, nonpartisan think tank that's based in Ann Arbor. Sarah is with us now via Skype. Sarah, what prompted you to want to dig in to learn just how women are doing?
Certainly now is a time when that question is being asked nationally with sort of more attention and focus than it has before. That made me curious to go back and look at sort of some of the same issues that we've explored for the entire state and see if they're hitting Michigan's women sort of differently than they are the general population.
And you did dig into a lot of different sources of data to put together the post. What were some of these sources you used?
I started with one of our sort of favorite reports, which comes out from the Michigan Association of United Way, is called their ALICE report, which is looking at a population of people who are living above the federal poverty level, but who are still really struggling to make ends meet. This turns out to be about 40% of Michigan's population. So I started there and then also expanded it by looking at census data and information from the Bureau of Labor Statistics.
Well, let's cut to the chase. How are Michigan's women doing?
The answer in my blog post was not great. The most striking thing that I found is really when you sort of put out the numbers that exist for the pay gap, and we know the pay gap is a problem nationally. When you really look at the numbers, it just hurts a little bit. And this is looking at all different levels of educational attainment, which is something I hadn't looked at before. When I look and see that women with a bachelor's degree, that their median income is less than that of men who have achieved some college or an associate's degree, you know, that really sort of struck a chord with me.
Also, men with a bachelor's degree are making more than women who have an advanced degree.
Yeah, this was true at every single level of education, that women were making less than men who'd achieved sort of the next lower tier of educational achievement.
And I know we're talking about Michigan, but one would suspect this is true across the country, no?
I think that this is pretty consistent with findings in a lot of places.
Sure. So back to Michigan, what does this mean, for example, making ends meet in households, especially the single women-led households with children?
Yeah, and that's where the ALICE report had a lot of good information. There are around 260,000 households that have children and are headed by women alone. Those households are really struggling. So around half of them are living in poverty. And then I believe another around 30% are sort of at that ALICE level where they are struggling to survive with sort of the basic necessities. And obviously childcare becomes a huge part of that household's budget.
You also found something I found, I guess, sadly unsurprising. You found women are underrepresented in the occupations that have the biggest paychecks, and the flip side, they're overrepresented in the lower paying jobs.
Yeah, this is related to sort of this growing trend that is really more the focus of Michigan Future's work, where we're not seeing a lot of growth in sort of middle wage, middle skill jobs. And so we're seeing that jobs that require a college degree are growing and those pay well, but that the other jobs that are growing are really low, don't require a lot of education, and pay terribly. And women are sort of overrepresented in some of those jobs, not mm-hmm. all, but it's a challenge that is difficult to untangle.
As far as education, you write in your blog post, Sarah, that that is one area where women are doing well compared with men in Michigan?
Yes. women are sort of achieving on par with men. However, Michigan as a whole is not doing well in terms of education. So we're really kind of underperforming in terms of getting our population to have the sort of representation in terms of college degrees that are helping economies to grow.
What about health? What's the broad picture for women in Michigan there?
I'm not a health researcher, but I found a really interesting data source that makes some sort of comparisons across the country. I found sort of one piece of good news, which is just that, especially due to the Medicaid expansion, Michigan is doing well in terms of health coverage for women. So we're 13th in the nation there. So that's great. But I found startling data around how we're doing in drug deaths and excessive drinking. We're sort of 37th and 40th there, and 33rd in terms of maternal mortality. And we're also doing pretty poorly in terms of funding women's health services. We're just a few away from last in that area.
And then you also say you didn't go looking for the statistic, but you found a pretty sorry one as far as how Michigan's doing in intimate partner violence.
Yeah, it showed that almost 42% of Michigan women are expected to experience intimate partner violence over their lifetime.
And you wrap up your two blog posts for Michigan Future, and I'll quote you here. Just for grins slash frowns, I counted the number of women in Michigan State House and Senate. What'd you find?
The percentage in the House was less than 30%. You'd hope that it would be 50 if we were just going for gender parity. But the House outperformed the state Senate, where only 13% of our representatives are women.
Did you find anything that jumped out at you as far as good news? Because it certainly seems like there's a lot of challenges. And as you say, Michigan's women not doing great.
I guess I would say the closest thing to good news is in terms of educational achievement that we are on par with men. But that actually also sort of follows a national trend. And what's really important from our perspective is we address that problem in its entirety, that we need to be providing access to better educational opportunities for our entire population.
So you've got this research out there now. You've got the blog post that you wrote for Michigan Future. What would you like to see happen with this information?
Well, we're advancing a report that is really an agenda for the entire state in terms of public policy that wrestles with some challenges that we don't think our leaders are addressing sufficiently right now. And that's just thinking really deeply about how is work changing and how are our educational demands for our community changing. So we're not doing a good job of preparing people in our state for a new economy that is upon us. And for the people who aren't faring well in this transition to a new economy, we don't want them and their children to be living in poverty. And so we really need to revisit some of the decisions we've made over the last 15 or 20 years that have reduced sort of the social safety net. You can see, especially for those families with children, there's a lot of policy recommendations in our report that would help them in terms of helping people find work that pays a family-supporting wage, and then supporting the people who just aren't going to make that transition. We want Michigan to be a high-prosperity state where jobs pay well and where if you work, you earn a decent living. And we're really far from that right now. And so we have a sort of policy agenda that we think addresses that.
What do you think the political will is to be able to look at these suggestions and look at these problems you point out and actually implement some of these policy changes?
I think there's a lot of evidence that our leaders believe that we only want to hear a message about the past. I believe that our communities are ready to hear about visions for making a successful transformation to sort of a future economy, that we know we are not going to have the economy of the 1960s again. We need to figure out how we can be successful in the new economy. So I don't see people grabbing that yet, but I think the citizens of Michigan are ready for a new agenda.
You'll find Sarah Shapicki's blog post by going to MichiganFuture.org. How are Michigan's women doing? Not great. There's actually two parts to this. Sarah Shapicki, a partner at New Solutions Group and a consultant to Michigan Future, Inc. Thanks so much for talking with us, Sarah.
Thanks for your interest.
And one note not mentioned in this interview. Shapicki obtained her health data from the American Health Rankings 2016 Health of Women and Children Report. Today's Stateside was directed by Allie Billings and engineered by Bob Scott. Stateside's executive producer is Joe Lindstraw. Contributors are Mike Blank, Danny Hensel, Mercedes Mejia, and Lindsay Scullin. Stateside is a production of Michigan Radio, a broadcasting service of the University of Michigan. I'm Cynthia Canty. Thank you so very much for listening.